So good morning, good Sunday morning, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists. We will begin with just to give a summary of who we are and what the lodge is, and then a brief statement on administrative announcements. So the United Lodge of Theosophists is an association of free-thinking individuals who see the value of keeping the wisdom tradition or the ancient wisdom religion before the public. If one is a student of theosophy, one takes on his own time and upon his own efforts, he makes the effort to study the principles, to see what it's all about, to compare perhaps to the principles of theosophy to what he or she has learned in life and see if there's a difference and weigh for oneself which one is closer to the truth and to test these ideas. This is not a religion. This is not a place where one would come and be expected to think in certain ways. However, we very definitely have a system of thought, a system of universal thought that is descended to us through ancient methods, races, nations, known as the ancient wisdom religion, and the modern day expression of that is known as the philosophy of theosophy. Now, the United Lodge of Theosophists is a group of students of theosophy, the purpose of which is to study together, because we all know that when we study together, we learn probably 10 times as much and 10 times faster than individually, but also an opportunity to test, check, and verify among ourselves to see if we're on the right track or to kind of compare notes and see if what we're studying kind of makes sense to triangulate with others to understand the philosophy more clearly. We are associates. We're not members of an organization. This is not an organization that has dues or passes the hat. There's no expectation along those lines. In fact, we don't really even have any officers or bylaws. There's no constitution. The guiding document for the United Lodge of Theosophists is a simple declaration of purpose, which everyone is encouraged to read and internalize if you care to. Because it is the one document upon which all of the United Lodges of Theosophists are based around the world. We will say that the Lodge regards as Theosophists all those who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and the Lodge welcomes to its association all those who find themselves in accord with its purposes and who wish to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others learn these ideas as well. So to fulfill the purposes of the Lodge, here in Philadelphia, we carry on two meetings per week. On a Sunday morning from 11 to 12 is a general lecture or a forum or a panel discussion about 15 to 20 minutes, or sometimes a little bit longer, but the most important part of all of our classes is the discussion, the talks, the questions and answers after it. For the month of October, the umbrella topic is for Sunday meetings. For the month of October, the umbrella topic we're covering is theosophy and the theosophical movement. In particular, this morning, the title for the presentation is The Timeless Message of Theosophy. On Wednesdays, we also have classes, which are from 7:30 to 8:30, and we're currently studying The Ocean of Theosophy, written by William Q. Judge. This is a text which walks students through the principles of the philosophy in a very comprehensive yet simple yet very deep way, and it's a wonderful book and it's a wonderful study. The Lodge opens on Wednesdays at 5:15 because we have a public reference library, and that's available from 5:15 to 7:15 each Wednesday. There is also a book table available in the foyer that carries straight line theosophical literature, which is available for purchase if you care to study at home. Available, and the price of the books are all at cost. This is not an organization that is in business for profit. But of course, virtually all of the original authoritative theosophical texts are online for free. And to find the best websites for that, we would encourage you to speak with the student at that book table. So the United Lodge of Theosophists is supported entirely by voluntary contributions of time, money, and effort, and all are welcome to contribute. But by all means, there is no obligations imposed or implied. So with that, our meeting is going to consist of a presentation of the topic at hand, the eternal message of theosophy, and that will be followed by questions, answers, and discussion.
I wonder how many of us have ever sat down and thought about the world that has changed around us, and how what was important for us to know at one time in our lives is far from the reality of today. It happens to us all at some period of our lives. We ask ourselves the questions relevant to our place in time. Example, do I get more money under my pillow for bigger teeth? Is Santa Claus real? I wonder what my new school is like. I wonder if he or she likes me. Later in life, we progress to the greater philosophical questions, like where did I come from? Where will I go? And sometimes too, if there is much suffering, we will also ask, who the heck is controlling my life? Is all life mere chance? Is there any justice in the world? Does God really exist? Or perhaps, why isn't life being fair to me? The great religions of the world have provided their followers answers to these questions. And answers to some of these are provided by modern scientific theories. But not all men find these answers completely satisfactory. If the answers satisfy the intellect, they fall often to satisfy the heart. Where the answers satisfy the heart, the mind often remains unconvinced. Thus it happens that in every land, in spite of the solutions offered by religion, philosophy, and science, there are men and women who are seeking for a more logical and inspiring solution. It is to these inquirers, these free thinkers, that theosophy offers a timeless and unique message. Theosophy as the wisdom religion has existed for immemorial time. It offers us a theory of nature and of life, which is founded upon knowledge acquired by the sages of the past, and that this knowledge is not imagined or inferred, but that it is an unchanging and eternal knowledge of facts. A knowledge seen and known by those who are willing to comply with the conditions requisite for seeing and knowing. As the oldest tradition of human wisdom, theosophy has been expressed in different ages by such as Krishna, Buddha, Pythagoras, Plato, and Jesus. Theosophy is not a faith, for faiths may be changed. But being knowledge which each can make his own, it is not dependent upon poor, miserable sinners or revelation. Theosophists do not demand acceptance of theosophy. We simply point out its principles and their applications. Theosophy makes certain statements, but as statements to be believed, but not as statements to be believed. The object of theosophy is to teach man what he is, through showing him the necessity of knowing for himself and becoming his own authority. The real meaning of the term theosophy is divine wisdom. Theosophia, or wisdom of the gods, the word, the real meaning of the term theosophy is divine wisdom. Theosophia, or wisdom of the gods. The word theos means God in Greek, one of the divine beings, certainly not God, in the sense attached in our day to the term. Therefore, it is not wisdom of God, as translated by some, but divine wisdom, such as possessed by the gods. The term is many thousands of years old. Theosophy is a body of ideas which are very old. Some of them are found in the religions and philosophies of India, Egypt, Greece, Palestine, and Arabia. Others come from the discoveries of scientists of the past and the present. Theosophy is not presented to you for your blind acceptance. It is not offered to you for total belief. It is put forth for your examination and judgment. What then are the main tenets of theosophy? First, that the universe is not just a place where nature's forces operate by chance. Every event that has happened from the beginning of time has happened according to certain laws inherent in the universe. These laws are the expressions of a consciousness. Everything that exists, from the electron to the largest star, is impregnated with consciousness. This fundamental reality is so far beyond our grasp that sages and saints have called it by contradictory terms. Many have termed it God. Some have called it law or heaven, as well as the great architect, and even evolution. Each man, according to his temperament and his experience, must determine how he will regard this consciousness which directs everything seen and unseen. Theosophy calls it deity. Sometimes we even call it God, but not meaning as most do in an anthropomorphic way. That is, not as a god in human form. The next great truth is that the nature of deity resides in every man and woman. We are not these bodies which perish. They are only garments which we wear for a while and then cast aside. We are immortal souls. The perfection of deity dwells in us also, for we live and move and have our being in him. But we are unconscious of our divine nature till we awaken to it. It is to realize our true nature that we are born. Our birth is as the entrance into a workshop or laboratory, where by work we slowly unfold our faculties. But it is not possible to realize the divine nature in us by the experiences of one lifetime. We enter into life, we are born, we grow, we act, we finish our work, and we return. Our return is death. After resting in a place called heaven by some, growing by realizing the joys we planned but did not achieve, we return to birth again, more purified, stronger, wiser, to work again so as to become more expert in thought and feeling and action. This is reincarnation. As we live and act, Sometimes we succeed. Sometimes we fail. We do good, we do evil, guided by our altruism or our selfishness. When we do evil, we create discord in the universal harmony, and we must restore that harmony. The evil we did must be balanced by a new good. The good we did must be reshaped to a more and far-reaching good. This process of sowing and reaping is called karma. It is the law of readjustment which a man puts into operation by every one of his thoughts, words, and deeds. Since all souls are divine, all souls are equal. There are young souls and old souls, but all are brothers. In spite of every difference of birth, capacity, environment, race, creed, sex, caste, or color, of goodness or of wickedness, all men form an indivisible brotherhood. All of us, high or low, ignorant or wise, make a chain, and the stronger grow by helping the weaker. Brotherhood is the law of growth for all men. But this brotherhood extends to all animals, birds, fish, even the planets, mountains, and seas. We grow by our unity with all things. The divine nature, which is latent in them, as in us, helps our inherent divinity to step forth in all its splendor. There are two eternal mysteries, the mystery of God and the mystery of man. All that we postulate concerning God of goodness, holiness, truth, and beauty resides in man. Religion, philosophy, science, the arts, commerce, industry, philanthropy, all these are channels along which the divine nature descends to reveal its magnificence. And our human nature ascends to divinity by growing in the virtues and capacities associated with these channels. Theosophy is a statement of the modes of action of the divine mind. All our questions are solved when once we understand God's plan, which is evolution. This understanding is the heritage of every soul, but he will possess it only as he learns to be a brother to all that lives. For loving action is the divine wisdom at work, and whoso acts lovingly will inevitably come to this enduring and ageless wisdom called theosophy. Once again, the topic for today is the timeless message of theosophy.
So we'll open the floor for contributions, yes?
We think from the talk and previous discussions, we understand where the message is coming from and what the message is, but who is the message directed to?
So the question here, who is this timeless message directed to? The modern day expression of the theosophical movement is one which is directed to mankind generally. There have been through the course of history, saviors of this civilization and of that people, and unique, or so to speak, saviors who were perceived as being unique. But theosophy per se is directed toward the human race. And it's not directed toward the human race by a savior, but simply by one who is a messenger who passes on to this time period this ageless wisdom, the ancient wisdom that has been known all through the ages and is available more so at some times or not available at other times, depending on the time of the cycle and how ready mankind is to use it for good. Yes.
It was mentioned about an eternal principle, something that is unchanging and from which everything comes. But we as mind beings is the same source of that. It says that as above, so below, we are a drop in that great ocean of life. That I guess what we're saying is that we all have that divine principle in us. If that is so, then we must have a life in that divinity. How do we approach that? How do we have that life? We know this, but how do we apply it? How do we go forward?
All right. So the contribution here is, if this idea of as above, so below is true, and as so many of us at least intuit, if there is a universal source of divinity, there is a spark of that divinity in me, but how do we know it, or what are we supposed to do with it, or how do we express it, and why does it seem to shine forth more brightly through some people than others, or maybe shines forth maybe through me in better ways or lesser ways, depending. So if it's constant, why isn't it always there? Okay, when we talk about the ancient wisdom, which is theosophy, we're talking about, simply put, divine truth. Divine truth. And the study of life is the learning of how to more fully participate in that divine truth. Our inner nature is truly divinity. Do we always act divine? Perhaps not. And so perhaps it's time to ask ourselves why, and maybe there are certain adjustments we can make to ourselves to more fully participate in the divine truth. Now, we're not saying that people who come to theosophy should change because they're not good enough. We're not saying that anybody is insufficient in any way, but we could say anybody who's ever looked in the mirror could probably think there's room for improvement. And if that's the case, the study of theosophy may point the way toward such improvement so that one can more fully understand how to live in harmony with life. Yes.
Could it be said then that the practice of theosophy is a practice in ethics and virtues?
So then the question is, would the practice of theosophy be the practice of ethics and virtue? Well, we're told that to more fully understand the ancient wisdom, step one is to live a virtuous life. Mr. Judge, who's one of the founders of the Theosophical movement, says that virtue, you know, when we say, well, why would that be the first step? It's because virtue, what is virtue? Virtue is moral courage. The courage to do what I know is the right thing to do, given the circumstances, regardless of other people's opinions, I know this is the right thing to do. And to do so without expecting anything in return. So step one is virtue. Why? Because that's an action, the reaction of which sets up certain things within us that attracts other ideas and other people along that very same line. And without being attracted to the teachings, how would we ever learn the teaching? So that sets up the conditions within ourselves is to learn live a virtuous life.
But virtue is sacrifice. We need to learn how to sacrifice. Sacrifice our lower nature to our higher nature, by doing things that I really don't want to give up. I'm really attached to them. But in the choice is, there's, you know, do I serve the higher or do I serve the lower?
So virtue is really giving something up, and when we're making moral choices, isn't typically that which we give up? Isn't it typically either our view about something or some kind of psychological block? I've always seen it this way, but you know what? I give in because it must be that, and I'm going to take a different course. So the practice of virtue, it would seem, is always going to require sacrifice.
And sacrifice really means to make sacred. So we try to make our lives sacred as we go. But the question also related to ethics, and every religion and philosophy has the same basic ethics. The difference in theosophy is the application of our will towards life, towards everyone and everything around us, is the resulting future for ourselves. In other words, karma is the principle under which we discipline ourselves. So if we don't practice ethics, what comes back to us is the same kind of treatment we have meted out to others. So it becomes the basis for making life sacred. It's a law, not a hope or a prayer.
Thank you. So on this topic of ethics that has to do with how we treat others comes around, it really has to do with how we treat ourselves. That's what ethics is all about. Ethics is all about, out in the world, typically, how we relate to other people. There, you know, we can imagine the difference between an ethical company and an unethical company. We don't need to go into the particulars. But from a theosophical perspective, when we talk about ethics, ethics starts with the relationship between ourself and our own inner nature, between the lower self and the higher. And the lower self doesn't mean the wrong, bad, or anything like that. It's just that part of the self that we use to operate in this world. And the question is, does the lower self sacrifice itself to the higher? Is the lower self willing to participate in divine truth? Surely we all know that at different times our lower self really wasn't willing maybe to do the right because this is more attractive. So ethics, theosophically speaking, first is the relationship we have with our own inner nature. And then that sets up a relationship with everybody else, with our outer world. Now there's a hand right here.
You know, what attracts one, looking in the window even, the terminology independent devotion. And the word independent is fine. Now, secondly, devotion is followed by the understanding devotion to whom and what. And then we come inside and we're offered a little yellow pamphlet, the policy of the smile. And it mentioned something about three fundamental principles. And we heard the terminology, test, check, and verify for yourself. We don't have to take anybody's word for it. And that keeps us coming and coming. And we learn how to define these terms in our own language and check, test, and verify.
Thank you. So that comment started out with this idea of independent devotion. A student of theosophy here at the lodge, we say, is independently devoted to the cause of theosophy. And the reason for that is because, as we said, this is not a religion. There's no priests. There's no one who's going to tell you what to think or how to think. But on the other hand, there is an authority. And the authority is the truth of the ideas presented, coupled with our ability to recognize the truth in those ideas. So an independent devotion to the cause of the ancient wisdom tradition is a position that one assumes that I'm going to learn this and I'm going to figure it out. And there's, and I will not allow myself to be diverted by some, you know, charismatic this or an overzealous intellectual that, but, you know, whatever it is within me that finds the, you know, the teachings are huge. But the path is one for each individual, and it's up to the individual by his own self-induced means and self-devised methods, which means pull yourself up by the britches and figure out how to do it. Thus, we come to understand theosophy, the ancient wisdom tradition, more and more as we grow and make the effort. Yes?
And to go along with that, one thing we think we have to remember is, as the Bhagavad Gita talks about, when we were talking about ethics and virtue, performing these acts for others and thinking, you know, high thoughts, they're not going to really mean much if we're doing it with the expectation that we're going to get something out of it. So that when we perform different types of acts with other people, they should be, the motive should be pure. The motive should not be, well, so-and-so is going to like me more, you know, what am I going to get out of doing this? That it should just be our duty as it comes to us under karma, and just do it because it's something that needs to be done.
So the contribution, once again, is if I'm making the effort to learn this and apply the principles, virtue comes into play. Why am I doing this? Is there a what's in it for me kind of thing? Well, sometimes when we get started, you know, it's so interesting. Yes, what's in it for me is I want to learn more about this stuff, and that's okay. But direct that one, what's in it to me, to continue to learn more and be humble about it, because there's so much to learn. So in essence, what we're saying is the karmic outcome of everything we do is directly related to the motive, the reason why we do it. Okay, so it's something to bear in mind. Why are we doing what we're doing? Yes.
It was said before that any one of us can look in the mirror and see room for improvement, or certainly see things in our nature we would consider faults and weaknesses we'd like to get rid of. So giving that, how is it possible that we could act with pure motive?
So the question is, how really can we act? It's almost like saying, here's a false statement. I'm a miserable sinner, therefore I can't have pure motive. No, that's the opposite of the teachings of theosophy. Perhaps we could say, I'm a spiritual being operating through this vehicle that I've created for myself all through this life and through previous lives. And given what I have, I'm going to do the best that I can with what I've got. And there's a lot of stuff in there. But I will live a mindful life. I will reflect on what I do. And having lived a life that is a reflectful, thoughtful, mindful life, I can yet still learn about what my own motive was. I can learn more about myself as I take the action in my attempt to live a pure life. And if it ends up that it wasn't as pure as I thought it was, well, at least I've learned that, right? Check that one off. Yes, in the back.
We think it's important, though, when we look at ourselves, as you said, I can do this, to realize it isn't the lower self is one thing and the higher self is another. There's only one self. I, the thinker, focused low or high. It's my choice. Part of it is past living, past conditions we've created, and the world around us. So it takes a bit of courage to stand and say, I want to see what I'm doing wrong, what keeps me from knowing my real spiritual nature. So it's a lot of work, but the outcome of that work is knowing truth and being kinder and more of a use to the universe.
So this contribution has to do with, someone who thinks about participating more in the lodge, who finds him or herself in accord with the principles, with the purposes of the lodge, who desires to fit himself to be the better able to help and teach others. That's what we're talking about. To fit ourselves to be the better able to help and teach others does not mean becoming a saint. It means learn more about myself, because the outcome of that is going to be the more we learn about ourselves, the more we can help others along their path as well, in whatever way that may be. So in our challenges, let's just remember, whatever comes to us karmically, when we handle it as a matter of virtue, and when we handle it reflectively and thoughtfully, if we learn the lesson that karma is bringing to us, it's done. It's not something that's going to keep on coming unless we ignore it, unless we choose to be selfish in spite of it. Yeah.
There's a statement you see in the philosophy. It's called the great heresy, that of separateness. That seems to be a real and constant danger. We look at the world in a very rational mind, and we see we are separate. But that is only an illusion. So, this idea of universal brotherhood is meaning that all of life is conscious, that everything is alive, and that's the reality, not what we believe or think?
Well, so we so often, and we don't even realize this, but we so often live our lives according to the dictates of the great heresy, for the simple reason that we fall into this tendency of actually believing, you're you, I'm me. You're over there, I'm over here. You have these differences in the way you look, think, talk, everything else in the world. And those differences are all of a physical nature which is irrelevant to the process of spiritual evolution, unless we're using it in terms of sacrifice. So the reality is, and this can be found in all the teachings and all of the religions, the reality is there's one source. We fundamentally are raised in our fundamental identity. We are at one with the universal oversoul. That's the reality. All differences, and there's a big difference between the word separate and the word difference. All differences are for the soul's experience. The purpose of manifestation is for the soul's experience. Separate means from different sources. Difference means, you can have white blood cells and red blood cells. They actually manifest from the same original cell, but they have different purposes to fulfill for the greater whole, right? So if we're talking about, when we talk about universal brotherhood, which was a term that was used in the 1800s, which had a very broad and specific meaning, and perhaps a better term we would use today, it would be like the infinite interconnectedness of all of life. In other words, there's not a thing we can say or do or feel or think that does not affect, that does not have a chain reaction, whether we see it or not. So if we identify with ourselves as spirit, then the he in me sees the he in thee. If we identify ourselves as this physical form, then isn't that the basis for all the problems of the world? Yeah.
What is the theosophist's view on disembodied spirits and spiritual possession?
What's the theosophical view on disembodied spirits and spiritual possession? Well, certainly that's a study, a broad study unto itself. There there are, how would we put it? There are entire universes floating all around, in and through and about us, that we do not identify with, nor can we see it in space. There are entire realities that our consciousness is not aware of. So what we're focused on is what to do with what we have according to our development of consciousness, right? Now, when we start talking about states between lives or life after death or anything along those lines, that's an entire process that a human being goes through from the time of death onward into his rebirth. And so it's a very definite teaching of theosophy. As far as possession along those lines, we certainly don't claim authority to be able to talk to that this morning, but that's what the library's for. There's plenty of interesting information along those lines. And it's probably not what most people think it is. Yeah.
I was thinking, based on what I've heard so far, perhaps that it was some form of a version of the self, higher or lower, communicating with the vehicle.
Okay. Well, we have to be careful of our words then. You know, so the word possession has certain implications, and certainly who we are is operating through this vehicle. The question is, what's the basis? What's the principle by which we operate? Is it our own personal desires, or is it higher principles? So we'll leave that there. Yeah.
The philosophy does teach that we can make ourselves so passive that literally someone else's mind could be affecting our own behavior. It is a separate and a serious study, and references can be found on it. We think the important thing to realize is the spirit that you are always in touch with is your own higher nature. And the effort is not to contact others, disembodied or not,
right,
but to bring yourself in line with the language of the soul, the behavior of the soul, and you will start to realize your own unity with all of life, and then there's nothing disembodied since you recognize the unity of all.
Thank you. And we would just finish that up with anything along the lines of mediumistic practices and all, we would really discourage anyone from participating in anything like that until you prove to yourself truly what it is. And then once you do prove to yourself, then you won't participate in it either. Yes.
Well, it's interesting to note, as pointed out, the timeless message of theosophy most recently presented to humanity in general first started to address the issue of spiritualism. What is it? And the message there was there's a difference between mediumship, which is passivity, and mediatorship, which is making ourselves porous to the influence of our own higher nature. So in both cases, we're talking about disembodied or spiritual entities which don't require a physical form, but in one case, we are using our will, and in the other case, we're not using our will, but allowing ourselves to be passive.
Thank you. Yes.
One of the things that we read when we were trying to find something meaningful for us before we came to theosophy, and we think probably most people of a certain age read it back in the day, was why do bad things happen to good people? And it was advised to us to read it, and we thought it was hogwash. And for us, we found theosophy shortly thereafter, because theosophy kind of answered all the questions. I mean, we're literally saying all the questions that we had, in regards to life and death, what happens after we die, do we come back, all of that, theosophy answered them all. So when we're looking at this idea of timeless, so our understanding then is that theosophy, the principles of the philosophy, have never changed then. And that is what we're looking at as being absolute truth. So we're thinking that that's probably the right thing.
Okay. And so when we're when we use the word timeless, it's kind of a big word to use. Where do we go with that? Like, how do you know? How can we see clearly that these ideas are timeless? Well, in the philosophy, you know, it's said that these ideas were ancient when the earth was young, and the ancient wisdom is simply the eternal truth made available to mankind in his incipient or at his nascent stage, when man first was able as a thinking being, as a physical form that was prepared to have an eternal mind soul incarnate into it, theosophy was made available by others who we would call elder brothers, who availed themselves to the human race to teach the principles, the foundations of science, philosophy, and religions. Now, that simply is the idea of how it was introduced. The ancient wisdom is eternal truth. Then there are the schools, the ancient mystery schools. And these ancient mystery schools were institutions by means of which man would refine himself to raise his consciousness in such a way to be able to participate in the divine truth. And these ancient mystery schools, you know, we talk about the eternal message, they were all over the ancient world. On every continent, and remnants of them are there. There were teachings for those who were more advanced or more lit. There were the teachings for those who were more of a spark, the exoteric as opposed to the esoteric teachings. So these schools, well, where were these schools? It's so easy to say they were all over the place. Well, we usually associate the ancient mystery schools with the cultures of Greece and Egypt. In Greece, there were the Eleusinian and the Dionysian and the Samothracian mystery schools, along with schools of philosophers such as Plato's Academy and in Athens and the Pythagorean school at Crotona. But these teachings from ancient Greece found their way to Rome. They were taught in the mystery schools called of Ishtar and Tammuz in Mesopotamia, modern day Iraq. There was in Iran, modern-day Iran, which was Persia. They were the Mithraic schools. These mystery schools were on the basis of the foundation of which was Zoroastrianism. But they were also in the Americas. In the Aztec, the Incas, the Mayan, we know of the common architecture with the pyramids of South America and of Egypt. Even in the North American Indians, there was the Ojibwe, it was called the Medawiwin, which is the Indian Medicine Lodge. That was a mystery school. Even among the Eskimos in North America and in the Arctic, they received their teachings from the Asians from across Siberia. Now, HPB traveled the world. It's said, if you stretch it all out, traveled the world three times around, comparing and contrasting the religions, the legends, and the mythologies of all civilizations, and showing that they all had one common basis. And that is part and parcel to learning theosophy, is learning the common principles in all the world's religions and philosophies. So prove it to yourself. We're not here to make anybody believe it, but it can be proven to oneself. Even to the modern day esoteric traditions we say modern day, but really arose in the 15th and 1600s, such as the Illuminati, the Freemasons, the Alchemists. These are all traditions or pearls. These are all pearls strung along what we could call a golden cord of the ancient wisdom. Each of these institutions or places or mystery schools is where the work was done to learn and to refine oneself. And yes, there's a hand.
Mm-hmm. I would like to give a clear picture of what it is.
Thank you. So the question is, what are we talking about when we talk about the higher and lower self? We all human beings are of the same stuff. We're compound beings. We have a compound nature made of different of principles of nature. But there's no one who is so spiritual that he's only this, or so unspiritual that he's only that. We're all the same stuff. The only difference between any of us is the degree of development, the degree of spiritual evolution that we've gone through. So when we talk about, and you'll hear that a lot in theosophy, the higher nature and the lower nature, it's not that each human being has two people or two selves or two brains or two minds. It relates to how we are using our mind and our hearts. How are we operating through it? Now, the higher self, so to speak, is that part of us which always has been and always will be. It is eternal. It is immortal. It is one with the Oversoul. It is one with the Absolute Divine. And it works through or operates through different principles which is our lower self. So this body, we know, we look at our physical body, it's alive today and dead tomorrow. Not a big deal, happens to everybody. But that doesn't mean that we change as soul beings. All it simply means is there's part of our compound nature is we have a physical body that has pretty much a set amount of time to get the things done that we're supposed to get done. There are seven actual constituents of the human being. And those which are temporary are the physical, our personal desires, our vitality, and our electromagnetic body, actually, that we use, around which the whole physical body builds itself. That is born and dies with each life, all of this. But our mind, our wisdom, and our truest spiritual nature lives forever. That's our higher self. Our lower self, when we're born, is what we're born into, and how we use that lower self sets up certain causes and effects through that life that affects the rest of the world and the future lives that we will ever live. Yes?
Could we say then that all intuition is remembering?
Could we say then that intuition is remembering? We would say, that's not what we would say, but the teaching of theosophy is that intuition is direct knowledge from the higher self. The ability to look upon something, a situation, absolutely know without figuring it out from logical premise to conclusion, I know that. That's intuition. Perhaps what we're thinking also about is conscience. Now, conscience can be remembering. If your conscience is directing you to do something, because, you know, I want to do this, but I probably should do that, that kind of a thing, then we've probably experienced that situation before and we know the right thing to do. And that's more along the line of inner remembering, perhaps. It's a lesson that we've learned in the past. And so hopefully we let our conscience be our guide so we don't have to relearn all those lessons all over again. Yes?
How would theosophy regard the use of other compounds like psychedelics or drugs as a means of spiritual growth?
Right. So how would theosophy look at psychedelics or other types of drugs as a means for spiritual growth? Well, really, one is depriving oneself of the ability to use his lower nature for spiritual growth if he defiles it. And when we're taking the, now you're not talking to a pharmacist here, but by all means, these psychedelics and other artificial external means by which we have certain experiences, that's all brain stuff. That's not of the higher. So consider these things if the option presents itself. Yes.
What's like the difference between having the right to enter a room for study and learning or trespassing or breaking down the door? You don't do yourself a service when you take something that you haven't been authorized to view or study or understand. But we wanted to go back for just a moment because so much of the world right now seems hopeless. But we can get hope from the fact that HPB, in her travels three times around, not only was checking and verifying what had been done in areas, but setting up lines of effort, encouraging the work that was going on, where it was going on, in whatever level. So we can remember that sort of dotted around our entire earth are those that are holding on to this wisdom and giving it out to the best of their ability. That should give us all hope. This effort by the adepts, by our elder brothers, never stops, no matter how we see the world in any condition. That work is always going on.
So the philosophy is always available, or should we say the teacher is always there for those who are ready. Yes.
Relating to the just previous talks, the Bhagavad Gita was not written as a manual during peacetime. Its sequel, the Anugita, was. But the Bhagavad Gita was written for a time of hilarity, chaos, warfare. The protagonist, Arjuna, is in the middle of a polarized nation, a polarized family, a chaotic family at war with one itself. And yet, it is in that time that he has the greatest opportunity for spiritual growth and has the access to the teacher. So in any time, and even sometimes in the worst of times, we have an opportunity that we wouldn't have at others.
Thank you for the contribution. So even when it seems like it's not the right time to start, sometimes the most challenging times are exactly the time when we should get started. Yes.
So basically the underlying thought is of, I think you hear that like universal brotherhood is a fact in nature, and that we should dwell upon the fact that we're not separate, that we're are all one, we're all connected, that we are a whole, and just consider ourselves as part of something much greater than what we individually think we are.
Thank you for the contribution. Let's draw an analogy along that line. When we're living our world, there's this way that perhaps we may tend to find ourselves thinking in this world, this workaday world, and so much stuff. And yes, we've made the effort to learn these ideas, whether it's out of a book with the word theosophy written on it, or in our own other path with other books, because it can be found everywhere. Here's the thing. It's if we use the analogy of living on the beach with this giant ocean available to us, the invitation is to always remember that, that ocean of theosophy is as broad and as deep as any mind can be. And if you're on the beach anyway, living your workaday world with distractions and things, just remember, you've already, if you're here today, you've already been attracted to these ideas in the past. And those ideas and that way of thinking of unity, of universal brotherhood, of I have the ability within me to be the virtuous person in this situation, that ocean is right there for you to step into. So we can step into it and get our feet wet and still operate in the workaday world. But remember, we always have these theosophical ideas and this point of view to step into, and always remember when we have the opportunity to go as deep, as far into it as we really care to. But in principle, it's understandable to all self-conscious people, even children. And with that, we have to close our meeting. Our meeting is adjourned. Thank you.